Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Great Short Stories of the World, selected by the editors of Reader's Digest. The Old Chief Mishlanga by Doris Lessing. They were good, the years of ranging the bush over her father's farm, which, like every white farm, was largely unused, broken only occasionally by small patches of cultivation. In between, nothing but trees, the long, sparse grass, thorn and cactus and gully, grass and outcrop and thorn, and a jutting piece of rock which has been thrust up from the warm soil of Africa unimaginable eras of time ago, washed into hollows and whorls by sun and wind that had traveled so many thousands of miles of space and bush, would hold the weight of a small girl whose eyes were sightless for anything but a pale, willowed river, a pale, gleaming castle. A small girl singing, out flew the web and floated wide, the mirror cracked from side to side. Pushing her way through the green aisles of the mealy stalks, the leaves arching like cathedrals veined with sunlight far overhead, with the packed red earth underfoot, a fine lace of red-starred witchweed would summon up a black bent figure croaking premonitions. The northern witch, bred of cold northern forests, would stand before her among the mealy fields, and it was the mealy fields that faded and fled, leaving her among the gnarled roots of an oak, snow falling thick and soft and white, the woodcutter's fire glowing red welcome through crowding tree trunks. A white child, opening its eyes curiously on a sun-suffused landscape, a gaunt and violent landscape, might be supposed to accept it as her own, to take the masasa trees and the thorn trees as familiars, to feel her blood running free and responsive to the swing of the seasons. This child could not see a masasa tree or the thorn for what they were. Her books held tales of alien fairies, her rivers ran slow and peaceful, and she knew the shape of the leaves of an ash or an oak, the names of the little creatures that lived in English streams, when the words the veld meant strangeness, though she could remember nothing else. Because of this, for many years, it was a veld that seemed unreal. The sun was a foreign sun, and the wind spoke a strange language. The black people on the farm were as remote as the trees and the rocks. They were an amorphous black mass, mingling and thinning and massing like tadpoles, faceless, who existed merely to serve, to say, yes, boss, take their money and go. They changed season by season, moving from one farm to the next, according to their outlandish needs, which one did not have to understand, coming from perhaps hundreds of miles north or east, passing on after a few months. Where? Perhaps even as far away as the fabled gold mines of Johannesburg, where the pay was so much better than the few shillings a month, and the double handful of mealy meal twice a day which they earned in that part of Africa. The child was taught to take them for granted. The servants in the house would come running 100 yards to pick up a book if she dropped it. She was called Nikosikas, chieftainess, even by the black children her own age. Later, when the farm grew too small to hold her curiosity, she carried a gun in the crook of her arm and wandered miles a day, from vley to vley, from copy to copy, accompanied by 2 dogs. The dogs and the gun were an armor against fear. Because of them, she never felt fear. If a native came into sight along the Kaffir paths 1/2 mile away, the dogs would flush him up a tree as if he were a bird. If he expostulated, in his uncouth language, which was by itself ridiculous, that was cheek. If one was in a good mood, it could be a matter for laughter. Otherwise, one passed on, hardly glancing at the angry man in the tree. On the rare occasions when white children met together, they could amuse themselves by hailing a passing native in order to make a buffoon of him. They could set the dogs on him and watch him run. They could tease a small black child as if he were a puppy, save that they would not throw stones and sticks at a dog without a sense of guilt. Later still, certain questions presented themselves in the child's mind, and because the answers were not easy to accept, they were silenced by an even greater arrogance of manner. It was even impossible to think of the black people who worked about the house as friends, for if she talked to one of them, her mother would come running anxiously. Come away, you mustn't talk to natives. It was this instilled consciousness of danger, of something unpleasant, that made it easy to laugh out loud, crudely, if a servant made a mistake in his English, or if he failed to understand an order. There is a certain kind of laughter that is fear, afraid of itself. One evening, when I was about 14, I was walking down the side of a mealy field that had been newly ploughed, so that the great red clod showed fresh and tumbling to the lay beyond, like a choppy red sea. It was that hushed and listening hour, when the birds send long, sad calls from tree to tree, and all the colors of earth and sky and leaf are deep and golden. I held my rifle in the curve of my arm, and the dogs were at my heels. In front of me, perhaps a couple of hundred yards away, a group of three Africans came into sight around the side of a big ant heap. I whistled the dogs close into my skirts and let the gun swing in my hand and advanced, waiting for them to move aside, off the path, in respect for my passing. But they came on steadily, and the dogs looked up at me for the command to chase. I was angry. It was cheek for a native not to stand off a path the moment he caught sight of you. In front walked an old man, stooping his weight on to a stick, his hair grizzled white, a dark red blanket slung over his shoulders like a cloak. Behind him came two young men carrying bundles of pots, assegais, hatchets. The group was not a usual one. They were not natives seeking work. These had an air of dignity, of quietly following their own purpose. It was the dignity that checked my tongue. I walked quietly on, talking softly to the growling dogs, until I was 10 paces away. Then the old man stopped, drawing his blanket close. "Morning, Nisosikas," he said, using the customary greeting for any time of the day. "Good morning," I said. "Where are you going?" My voice was a little truculent. The old man spoke in his own language. Then one of the young men stepped forward politely and said in careful English, "My chief travels to see his brothers beyond the river." A chief, I thought, understanding the pride that made the old man stand before me like an equal. More than an equal, for he showed courtesy, and I showed none. The old man spoke again, wearing dignity like an inherited garment, still standing 10 paces off, flanked by his entourage, not looking at me, that would have been rude, but directing his eyes somewhere over my head at the trees. "You are the little Nikosikas from the farm of Boss Jordan?" "That's right," I said. "Perhaps your father does not remember," said the interpreter for the old man, "but there was an affair with some goats. I remember seeing you when you were..." The young man held his hand at knee level and smiled. We all smiled. "What is your name?" I asked. "This is Chief Mishlanga," said the young man. "I will tell my father that I met you," I said. The old man said, "My greetings to your father, little Nikosikas." "Good morning," I said politely, finding the politeness difficult from lack of use. "Morning, little Nikosikas," said the old man, and stood aside to let me pass. I went by, my gun hanging awkwardly, the dogs sniffing and growling, cheated of their favorite game of chasing natives like animals. Not long afterwards, I read in an old explorer's book the phrase, "Chief Mishlanga's country." It went like this. Our destination was Chief Mishlanga's country, to the north of the river, and it was our desire to ask his permission to prospect for gold in his territory. The phrase, "ask his permission," was so extraordinary to a white child, brought up to consider all natives as thing to use, that it revived those questions which could not be suppressed. They fermented slowly in my mind. On another occasion, one of those old prospectors who still move over Africa looking for neglected reefs, with their hammers and tents and pans for sifting gold from crushed rock, came to the farm and, in talking of the old days, used that phrase again. This was the old chief's country, he said. It stretched from those mountains over there way back to the river, hundreds of miles of country. That was his name for our district, the old chief's country. He did not use our name for it, a new phrase that held no implication of usurped ownership. As I read more books about the time when this part of Africa was opened up, not much more than 50 years before, I found old Chief Mishlanga had been a famous man, known to all the explorers and prospectors. But then he had been young, or maybe it was his father or uncle they spoke of. I never found out. During that year, I met him several times in the part of the farm that was traversed by natives moving over the country. I learned that the path up the side of the big red field where the birds sang was the recognized highway for migrants. Perhaps I even haunted it in the hope of meeting him, being greeted by him. The exchange of courtesies seemed to answer the questions that troubled me. Soon I carried a gun in a different spirit. I used it for shooting food and not to give me confidence. And now the dogs learned better manners. When I saw a native approaching, we offered and took greetings, and slowly that other landscape in my mind faded, and my feet struck directly on the African soil, and I saw the shapes of tree and hill clearly, and the black people move back, as it were, out of my life. It was as if I stood aside to watch a slow, intimate dance of landscape and men, a very old dance, whose steps I could not learn. But I thought, this is my heritage, too. I was bred here. It is my country as well as the black man's country, and there is plenty of room for all of us without elbowing each other off the pavements and roads. It seemed it was only necessary to let free that respect I felt when I was talking with old Chief Mshlanga, to let both black and white people meet gently with tolerance for each other's differences. It seemed quite easy. Then one day something new happened. Working in our house as servants were always three natives, cook, houseboy, garden boy. They used to change as the farm natives changed, staying for a few months, then moving on to a new job or back home to their kraals. They were thought of as good or bad natives, which meant, how did they behave as servants? Were they lazy, efficient, obedient, or disrespectful? If the family felt good-humored, the phrase was, what can you expect from raw black savages? If we were angry, we said, these damn niggers, we would be much better off without them. One day a white policeman was on his rounds of the district, and he said laughingly, did you know you have an important man in your kitchen? What? Exclaimed my mother sharply. What do you mean? A chief's son, the policeman seemed amused. He'll boss the tribe when the old man dies. He'd better not put on a chief's son act with me, said my mother. When the policeman left, we looked with different eyes at our cook. He was a good worker, but he drank too much at weekends. That was how we knew him. He was a tall youth with very black skin, like black polished metal. His tightly growing black hair parted white man's fashion at one side, with a metal comb from the store stuck into it. Very polite, very distant, very quick to obey an order. Now that it had been pointed out, we said, of course you can see. Blood always tells. My mother became strict with him now that she knew about his birth and prospects. Sometimes when she lost her temper, she would say, you aren't the chief yet, you know. And he would answer her very quietly, his eyes on the ground. Yes, Nikosikas. One afternoon, he asked for a whole day off instead of the customary half day to go home next Sunday. How can you go home in one day? It will take me half an hour on my bicycle, he explained. I watched the direction he took, and the next day I went off to look for his kraal. I understood he must be Chief Mshlanga's successor. There was no other kraal near enough our farm. Beyond our boundaries on that side, the country was new to me. I followed unfamiliar paths past Kapis. That, until now, had been part of the jagged horizon hazed with distance. This was government land, which had never been cultivated by white men. At first I could not understand why it was that it appeared, in merely crossing the boundary, I had entered a completely fresh type of landscape. It was a wide green valley where a small river sparkled, and vivid water birds darted over the rushes. The grass was thick and soft to my calves, the trees stood tall and shapely. I was used to our farm, whose hundreds of acres of harsh, eroded soil bore trees that had been cut for the mine furnaces and had grown thin and twisted, where the cattle had dragged the grass flat, leaving innumerable crisscrossing trails that deepened each season into gullies under the force of the rains. This country had been left untouched, save for prospectors whose picks had struck a few sparks from the surface of the rocks as they wandered by, and for migrant natives whose passing had left, perhaps, a charred parch on the trunk of a tree where their evening fire had nestled. It was very silent, a hot morning with pigeons cooing throatily, the midday shadows lying dense and thick with clear yellow spaces of sunlight between, and in all that wide green park-like valley, not a human soul but myself. I was listening to the quick, regular tapping of a woodpecker when slowly a chill feeling seemed to grow up from the small of my back to my shoulders, in a constricting spasm like a shudder, and at the roots of my hair a tingling sensation began and ran down over the surface of my flesh, leaving me goose-fleshed and cold, though I was damp with sweat. Fever? I thought, then uneasily turned to look over my shoulder and realized suddenly that this was fear. It was extraordinary, even humiliating. It was a new fear. For all the years I had walked by myself over this country, I had never known a moment's uneasiness. In the beginning, because I had been supported by a gun and the dogs, then because I had learnt an easy friendliness for the Africans I might encounter. I had read of this feeling, how the bigness and silence of Africa under the ancient sun grows dense and takes shape in the mind, till even the birds seem to call menacingly, and a deadly spirit comes out of the trees and the rocks. You move warily as if your very passing disturbs something old and evil, something dark and big and angry that might suddenly rear and strike from behind. You look at groves of entwined trees and picture the animals that might be lurking there. You look at the river running slowly, dropping from level to level through the vley, spreading into pools where at night the bucks come to drink and the crocodiles rise and drag them by their soft noses into underwater caves. Fear possessed me. I found I was turning round and round because of that shapeless menace behind me that might reach out and take me. I kept glancing at the files of copies, which, seen from a different angle, seemed to change with every step, so that even known landmarks, like a big mountain that had sentineled my world since I first became conscious of it, showed an unfamiliar sunlit valley among its foothills. I did not know where I was. I was lost. Panic seized me. I found I was spinning round and round, staring anxiously at this tree and that, peering up at the sun which appeared to have moved into an eastern slant, shedding the sad yellow light of sunset. Hours must have passed. I looked at my watch and found that this state of meaningless terror had lasted perhaps 10 minutes. The point was that it was meaningless. I was not 10 miles from home. I had only to take my way back along the valley to find myself at the fence. Away among the foothills of the kopjes gleamed the roof of a neighbor's house, and a couple of hours' walking would reach it. This was a sort of fear that contracts the flesh of a dog at night and sets him howling at the full moon. It had nothing to do with what I thought or felt, and I was more disturbed by the fact that I could become its victim than of the physical sensation itself. I walked steadily on, quietened in a divided mind, watching my own pricking nerves and apprehensive glances from side to side with a disgusted amusement. Deliberately I set myself to think of this village I was seeking and what I should do when I entered it. If I could find it, which was doubtful, since I was walking aimlessly and it might be anywhere in the hundreds of thousands of acres of bush that stretched about me. With my mind on that village, I realized that a new sensation was added to the fear, loneliness. Now such a terror of isolation invaded me that I could hardly walk, and if it were not that I came over the crest of a small rise and saw a village below me, I should have turned and gone home. It was a cluster of thatched huts in a clearing among trees. There were neat patches of mealies and pumpkins and millet, and cattle grazed under some trees at a distance. Fowls scratched among the huts, dogs lay sleeping on the grass, and goats freezed a copy that jutted up beyond a tributary of the river, lying like an enclosing arm round the village. As I came close, I saw the huts were lovingly decorated with patterns of yellow and red and ochre mud on the walls, and the thatch was tied in place with plates of straw. This was not at all like our farm compound, a dirty and neglected place, a temporary home for migrants who had no roots in it. And now I did not know what to do next. I called a small black boy who was sitting on a lot playing a string gourd, quite naked except for the strings of blue beads round his neck, and said, "Tell the chief I am here." The child stuck his thumb in his mouth and stared shyly back at me. For minutes I shifted my feet on the edge of what seemed a deserted village, till at last the child scuttled off, and then some women came. They were draped in bright cloths, with brass glinting in their ears and on their arms. They also stared silently, then turned to chatter among themselves. I said again, "Can I see Chief Mlishlanga?" I saw they caught the name. They did not understand what I wanted. I did not understand myself. At last I walked through them and came past the huts and saw a clearing under a big shady tree, where a dozen old men sat cross-legged on the ground, talking. Chief Mlishlanga was leaning back against a tree, holding a gourd in his hand, from which he had been drinking. When he saw me, not a muscle of his face moved, and I could see he was not pleased. Perhaps he was afflicted with my own shyness due to being unable to find the right forms of courtesy for the occasion. To meet me on our own farm was one thing, but I should not have come here. What had I expected? I could not join them socially. The thing was unheard of. Bad enough that I, a white girl, should be walking the vled alone, as a white man might, and in this part of the bush where only government officials had the right to move. Again I stood, smiling foolishly, while behind me stood the groups of brightly clad, chattering women, their faces alert with curiosity and interest. And in front of me sat the old men with old, lined faces, their eyes guarded, aloof. It was a village of ancients and children and women. Even the two young men who kneeled beside the chief were not those I had seen with him previously. The young men were all away working on the white men's farms and mines, and the chief must depend on relatives who were temporarily on holiday for his attendance. "The small white Nikosikas is far from home," remarked the old man at last. "Yes," I agreed, "it is far. I wanted to say, I have come to pay you a friendly visit, Chief Mishlanga. I could not say it. I might now be feeling an urgent, helpless desire to get to know these men and women as people, to be accepted by them as a friend, but the truth was I had set out in a spirit of curiosity. I had wanted to see the village that one day our cook, the reserved and obedient young man who got drunk on Sundays, would one day rule over." "The child of Nkosi Jordan is welcome," said Chief Mishlanga. "Thank you," I said, and could think of nothing more to say. There was a silence while the flies rose and began to buzz around my head, and the wind shook a little in the thick green tree that spread its branches over the old men. "Good morning," I said at last. "I have to return now to my home." "Morning, little Nikosika," said Chief Mishlanga. I walked away from the indifferent village, over the rise, past the staring amber-eyed goats, down through the tall stately trees into the great rich green valley where the river meandered and the pigeons cooed tales of plenty and the woodpecker tapped softly. The fear had gone, the loneliness had set into stiff-necked stoicism. There was now a queer hostility in the landscape, a cold, hard, sullen indomitability that walked with me, as strong as a wall, as intangible as smoke. It seemed to say to me, "You walk here as a destroyer." I went slowly homewards with an empty heart. I had learned that if one cannot call a country to heel like a dog, neither can one dismiss the past with a smile and an easy gush of feeling, saying, "I could not help it, I am also a victim." I only saw Chief Mishlanga once again. One night my father's big red land was trampled down by small sharp hooves, and it was discovered that the culprits were goats from Chief Mishlanga's kraal. This had happened once before, years ago. My father confiscated all the goats. Then he sent a message to the old chief that if he wanted them, he would have to pay for the damage. He arrived at our house at the time of sunset one evening, looking very old and bent now, walking stiffly under his regally draped blanket, leaning on a big stick. My father sat himself down in his big chair below the steps of the house. The old man squatted carefully on the ground before him, flanked by his two young men. The palaver was long and painful because of the bad English of the young man who interpreted, and because my father could not speak dialect but only kitchen Kaffir. From my father's point of view, at least 200 pounds worth of damage had been done to the crop. He knew he could not get the money from the old man. He felt he was entitled to keep the goats. As for the old chief, he kept repeating angrily, 20 goats! My people cannot lose 20 goats. We are not rich like the Nkosi Jordan to lose 20 goats at once." My father did not think of himself as rich, but rather as very poor. He spoke quickly and angrily in return, saying that the damage done meant a great deal to him and that he was entitled to the goats. At last it grew so heated that the cook, the chief's son, was called from the kitchen to be interpreter, and now my father spoke fluently in English, and our cook translated rapidly so that the old man could understand how very angry my father was. The young man spoke without emotion, in a mechanical way, his eyes lowered but showing how he felt his position by a hostile, uncomfortable set of the shoulders. It was now in the late sunset, the sky a welter of colors, the birds singing their last songs, and the cattle, lowing peacefully, moving past us toward their sheds for the night. It was the hour when Africa is most beautiful, and here was this pathetic, ugly scene, doing no one any good. At last my father stated finally, "I'm not going to argue about it, I am keeping the goats." The old chief flashed back in his own language, "That means that my people will go hungry when the dry season comes." "Go to the police, then," said my father, and looked triumphant. There was, of course, no more to be said. The old man sat silent, his head bent, his hands dangling helplessly over his withered knees. Then he rose, the young men helping him, and he stood facing my father. He spoke once again very stiffly and turned away and went home to his village. "What did he say?" asked my father of the young man, who laughed uncomfortably and would not meet his eyes. "What did he say?" insisted my father. Our cook stood straight and silent, his brows knotted together. Then he spoke. "My father says, all this land you call yours, is his land and belongs to our people." Having made this statement, he walked off into the bush after his father, and we did not see him again. Our next cook was a migrant from Nyasaland with no expectations of greatness. Next time the policeman came on his rounds, he was told this story. He remarked, "That kraal has no right to be there. It should have been moved long ago. I don't know why no one has done anything about it. I'll have a chat with the native commissioner next week. I'm going over for tennis on Sunday anyway." Some time later, we heard that Chief Mishlanga and his people had been moved 200 miles east to a proper native reserve. The government land was going to be opened up for white settlement soon. I went to see the village again about a year afterwards. There was nothing there. Mounds of red mud where the huts had been had long swaths of rotting thatch over them, veined with red galleries of the white ants. The pumpkin vines rioted everywhere, over the bushes, up the lower branches of trees, so that the great golden balls rolled underfoot and dangled overhead. It was a festival of pumpkins. The bushes were crowding up, the new grass sprang vivid green. The settler lucky enough to be allotted the lush, warm valley, if he chose to cultivate this particular section, would find, suddenly, in the middle of a mealy field, the plants were growing 15 feet tall, the weight of the cobs dragging at the stalks, and wonder what unsuspected vein of richness he had struck. And that story was The Old Chief Mishlanga by Doris Lessing, from the great short stories of the world selected by the editors of Reader's Digest. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Best Love Stories Told at the National Storytelling Festival, printed by National Storytelling Press. Willie the Bug Man by Susan Klein. Years ago in my kindergarten classroom, there was a little blonde, brown-eyed boy who sparkled when he spoke. Each day he brought a shoebox to school and put it on the long blue shelf that edged the immense south-facing windows in our room. Every box contained a variation on the same theme, bugs. Willie found these fuzzy little six-legged critters, striped, winged, and dotted, in the woods and fields near his house and brought them for us to see. Willie was more than a collector. He was also a caretaker, for he knew dozens of things about his bugs. He knew where they lived, what they ate, where they went when it rained, and whom they hung out with on Friday nights. He fed them and talked to them and enlightened us with pertinent information concerning them. All this trafficking with bugs earned him the name Willie the Bug Man. One day he brought to school a large glass mayonnaise jar the size restaurants use. His dad and mom had helped him clean it up and hammer a screwdriver point into the cap to make air holes. Inside the jar, 7 black, white, and greenish-yellow striped caterpillars marched round and round. I said, "Willie, those are mighty beautiful caterpillars. Where are we going to put them?" He said, "On the window shelf with the others." "Oh, Willie, I don't think that's a good idea. On that shelf, the sun beats down so hot that your caterpillars will fry in that glass jar." "Don't worry about a thing, Miss Klein. Check in here," Willie said, as he pointed over his shoulder to his blue backpack. By this time of the school year, I knew enough to unzip the backpack and peer inside. Willie always had surprises in there. This time I discovered a bouquet of milkweed plants without the pods. "What's this for, Willie?" "Shade and food," he said gleefully. Then he took the bouquet, opened the lid, jammed the leafy stems in the jar, and tightened the lid. As he put the jar on the windowsill, we could see the caterpillars already climbing up the stems and hanging upside down under the leaves. Willie said, "See? Shade." The next day when we came to school, everyone dashed over to the jar. The leaves were gone, the stems were dry and shriveling, and the caterpillars were once again marching around the bottom of the jar. "Willie," I said, "what are we going to do for them today?" "Don't worry about a thing, Miss Klein. Check in here," he said, pointing to his backpack again. There I found another bouquet of milkweed plants he'd gathered on the way to school. And so it continued. Every day, Willie would take out the old stems and install a new serving of shade and food. The caterpillars thrived. There was another fellow in our room who just loved those caterpillars. Marlin was one of those kids who loved to touch things. Every day he would literally wrap himself around the jar and hug it until I could persuade him to try another activity. He simply loved those caterpillars. Some days his friends, as he called them, would stay on his desk throughout the school day. During the weeks that followed, we studied caterpillars while ours grew longer and thicker. We saw film strips about caterpillars, read stories, drew and painted pictures, wrote poetry, and made caterpillars from egg cartons and pipe cleaners. We even became caterpillars. One day, Marlin came up to me and pulled at my skirt with a pathetic look on his face. "Miss Klein," he said, "they're gone." "Who's gone?" "My friends." I said, "Marlin, come on, how could they be gone? They were much too fat to get through the holes in the lid." He took my hand and led me to the jar. They were gone. I said, "Marlin, did you let them out?" "No, Miss Klein, they were my friends. I wouldn't do that. I knew they had to stay in there." I said, "Well, Marlin, let's wait until Willie the Bug Man comes. He'll probably know what's happened." When Willie got to school, Marlin raced to meet him. We all stood around the empty jar. Willie said, "Let's look closer." I opened the lid and we all looked in through the top, though we could see perfectly well through the glass jar. In the nick of time, I lifted the lid straight up before Marlin could grab the 7 cocoons that we could now plainly see hanging from the underside of the lid. Marlin just looked up, smiling and smiling at the 7 lime green pods that held his friends. Willie said, "Miss Klein, why don't you stick the lid to that high shelf?" So I did. Using masking tape, I attached the rim of the lid to the underside of my highest library shelf. Every day, Marlin would stare at them for a while and then come announce to the class, "Chrysalis report, light green, gold dots, 1 black line." Next day, "Chrysalis report, still green with gold dots and 1 black line." Next day, "Chrysalis report, green, no dots, 1 black line." Next day, "Chrysalis report, greenish, no dots, no lines." Next day, "Chrysalis report, gray and green." Finally, one day he said, "Chrysalis report, prunes." We all stopped what we were doing and everyone said, "Prunes?" "Yeah, prunes," he repeated with a quizzical look on his face. Marlin was right. The chrysalises were no longer fresh and green. They looked like 7 prunes hanging from the lid. When Marlin asked me what was wrong with them, I couldn't answer very positively, but I did tell him that the situation didn't look good. The next day we got no chrysalis report. Marlin began crying as soon as he saw them. "Miss Klein, why did my friends have to die?" he said as his little shoulders heaved. "Marlin, I knew you loved them very, very much," I said. "I wish I could tell you why they died, but I can't." "Can we have a funeral?" he asked in a whisper. "Well, of course. Tomorrow I'll bring in a special box and we'll have a ceremony under our maple tree." He seemed somewhat satisfied with that and spent the rest of the day mourning his friends. The following day, I brought to school an old wooden cigar box painted with palm trees. I envisioned the kids standing in the cemetery across the street from the school under the maple tree whose changes we observed from our window all year long. I knew it would be a mighty solemn affair. But when I got to school, Willie and Marlin were already there, shrieking and jumping up and down outside our classroom windows. When I walked up, they hollered, "Hey, Miss Klein, take a look at this!" My eyes traveled to the spot the boys were pointing to, and there, on the other side of the glass, I saw 7 beautiful monarch butterflies. Willie's eyes were shining, and Marlin was grinning all over himself. For a bit, we just stood there and watched them fluttering. "What do you think of that?" I asked. "I think you gotta get pretty ugly before you get beautiful again," said Willie. We went inside, opened all the windows, and propped open the outside door. As the kids came onto the playground, they all ventured by to look at the magic that had taken place. There was much chatter and speculation by the whole school population that day. We kept our coats on once school began and left everything open so that the butterflies could find the breeze and slip away to their new lives to find food and water and a place to rest, as Willie the Bug Man said they would. We had a lot of work to do that day, but someone always had an eye on the butterflies' action. When the first one escaped, the watcher's shriek of joy alerted the rest of us, and we laughed and stared in wonder at Marlin's friends flying around. By the end of the day, we had heard 7 shrieks, and all the butterflies had entered the wider world. The following year, my class went on to a new teacher. Willie the Bug Man brought my new class a gift, a large jar of caterpillars. "These new kindergartners need to know how it all really happens," he said. Unfortunately, that batch didn't make it, and the magic of that first year was never repeated. Shortly thereafter, I left my teaching job to go onto the road as a touring storyteller. 6 years later, in the fall of 1988, as I was preparing to head for Tennessee, I heard a knock at the kitchen door. There stood Willie the Bug Man, all grown up and in junior high. I hadn't seen him in years. Silently, he handed me a present wrapped up in fluffy white tissue paper with a big red ribbon. The card read, "It'll always be real special between you and me." I tugged at the ribbon and the paper fell away, revealing a large white gauze butterfly with rainbows painted on its wings. Willie and I visited for a bit while I hung the butterfly in my kitchen. It still flies there, and when I come home from telling stories all over America, it's the first thing I see as I come in the kitchen door. It still reminds me of the important things that Marlin and Willie the Bug Man taught me. And that was Willie the Bug Man by Susan Klein, from Best Love Stories Told at the National Storytelling Festival. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, selected by the editors of Reader's Digest. The Nightingale by Maxim Gorky. The paddle steamer was proceeding on its way between Kazan and Kozlovka. It was quiet and fresh on the Volga. Evening was falling. A lilac-colored mist was beginning to envelop the hilly bank of the river. The opposite bank of meadowland had been flooded and pushed far back to the horizon. In places, green islets of submerged trees rose above the water. The noise of the paddles sounded dully in the damp, thick air, heavy with the fragrance of fresh foliage. A broad band of foaming water stretched behind the steamer, and waves were sent rolling toward both banks. The sunset was burning down ahead of the steamer, and night was catching up in the rear. Here and there in the darkening sky, stars kindled faintly. A group of first-class passengers on the promenade deck was muted to a minor key under the influence of the melancholy evening, which was nascent on the river. There were four passengers seated there, an old man, tall and stooping, wearing a soft, wide-brimmed hat, the brim of which overshadowed the whole of his face, including the beard. Beside him sat a young lady wrapped closely in a gray shawl, staring dreamily out of her blue eyes at the hilly wooded bank. Not far from them on the same bench sat another pair, a dry-looking gentleman in a gray overcoat and a buxom, shapely lady with regular features and large, dark eyes. The gentleman next to her, who was nervously twisting his carefully trimmed French beard, leaned forward slightly and seemed to twitch. The lady, on the other hand, had settled against the back of the bench and sat there as immobile as a statue. The old man, gripping his cane with both hands and resting his chin on them, hunched himself forward and stared fixedly at the deck. They were all silent. The steamer shuddered as it moved forward rapidly. Somewhere below could be heard the intrusive clatter of dishes, the trampling of feet, and peals of laughter, and from the stern floated a subdued, almost sighing song, which was lost every now and again in all the noises that had blended into one smooth, monotonous wave of abrupt and incomplete sounds. "A bit fresh, isn't it? Shouldn't we go down to our cabins, eh?" the old man suggested, raising his head. In the meantime, floating from somewhere a good way off, came a strange, husky whistling that resembled a yearning, long-restrained sigh from some small but powerful and very passionate breast. The passengers raised their heads. "A nightingale!" the old man exclaimed with a laugh. "A little early, isn't it?" "Let's stay and listen, Papa," the young lady suggested. "As you wish. You may stay here, and they have no objection either," he answered, rising. "But I'll be off. After all, nightingales are not my—" But leaving his sentence unfinished, the old man sat down again. The nightingale's ringing, joyful, nerve-stirring trill rang and lilted through the air. The notes rushed so fast, so impetuously, one after the other, that it seemed the songster was afraid he would have no time to say everything he wanted to say in his song. Nervously quivering roulades were suddenly interrupted by husky, sighing sounds, somehow very descriptive of a deeply yearning, impassioned heart. Once more the feverish pizzicato spattered through the air, vanishing abruptly and giving place to a minor melody, interrupted in its turn by a sort of crackling sound as if the singer were smacking his lips at his own song. Everything on the steamer grew hushed. Every noise, except for the monotonous thud of the paddle wheels, had vanished somewhere. The song poured out and ruled both the river and the passengers, who listened to it in silence. The young lady smiled dreamily. The married lady's face lost something of its seriousness and strictness. The old man sighed and said, "There we have it, the playful and fantastic wisdom of nature. A small useless bird is endowed with such a wealth of tone. But the cow, though a useful animal, is capable only of uttering a single unpleasant mooing tone. Both in our life and in nature, men find the crude and ugly useful, whereas what is beautiful and enjoyable, touching to the soul, man finds useless." "Don't talk, Papa, I can't hear," the daughter exclaimed tartly. The father smiled skeptically and growled again, "But you must agree that if cows sang like nightingales, it wouldn't be at all bad, eh?" "Do stop it, Papa," the daughter implored. All right, I'll keep quiet. But he stopped too, that rhapsodist of love. Have you had your fill? Well, shall we go down to the cabins?" "Let's sit here a little longer," the married lady said slowly in a hushed voice. The nightingale was still singing, but now his song had grown faint and dying. The sunset had burned out. The waters of the Volga had grown dark and solid-looking. The moon was climbing, and the hilly bank cast dark shadows upon the calm surface. There was the gleam of a bonfire in the hollow of a hill, and the crimson band of the reflected fire sparkled and quivered on the river. It was wonderfully quiet. The nightingale's song broke off. A sailor appeared on the promenade deck. For a while he shuffled about on one spot, then he removed his leather cap, looked at the passengers, and resolutely approached them. "You wouldn't like to hear the nightingale, would you?" he inquired rather awkwardly for some reason. "What's that?" the old man asked squeamishly with a wry expression. "The nightingale, if you wish. There's a boy here who whistles like a regular nightingale." "God's truth," the sailor explained, backing away from the old man's piercing scrutiny. "Bring him along," the married lady said curtly. The man beside her began to shift nervously on the bench. "Is it necessary, Nina?" he demanded, frowning sourly. The young lady stared at the sailor with wide-open eyes. "Would you want me to bring him?" the sailor asked again. "Yes, of course, I told you so," the lady snapped angrily. "He'll come by himself," the sailor clarified, and then disappeared. "The devil knows what this is," the old man explained, raising his brows. "Some sort of a boy who whistles like a regular nightingale. We heard him already, believing he was a real nightingale, and listening to him, one of us began philosophizing. What a wild fowl!" And he shook his head reproachfully, feeling embarrassed by this wild fowl. A boy of about 14 appeared on deck. He was wearing a jacket, narrow trousers, and on his head a new visored cap tipped slightly to one side. His freckled face, his rolling gait, his thick short fingers, and his sun-bleached yellow hair proclaimed him to be a villager. He approached the group, removed his visored cap, bowed, shook his head, and leaving it uncovered, silently began to fidget with the visor as if trying to straighten it. The passengers also scrutinized him in silence. There was a puzzled look in the young lady's eyes. The boy's gray eyes swept boldly over their faces. "Would you have me whistle?" he asked. "Was it you whistling just now like a nightingale?" the old man inquired. "Yes, me. The barman had asked me. Is that all you do, whistle?" "Exactly so. I board the steamer and travel as far as Kazan. Then I do the return trip from Kazan." "Well, then let's hear you whistle, please." "I don't want to hear it," the young lady said in a low voice. The boy looked at her, puzzled. "Who taught you this?" the married lady asked the boy in a husky contralto. "Why, I myself. I was a herds boy. I come from hereabouts," he said, waving his hand vaguely towards the river bank. "From a village. I be minding the herd and listening all day to all sorts of birds. So I began whistling to the birds myself. Well, and so I learned little by little. I can whistle like a siskin. The robin, too, but that's not as rousing as the nightingale. And I've become such a good hand at the nightingale that I even take in the hunters. I'll sit in the bushes and let rip, just like a real bird, honest." As he talked, the boy's face glowed with the proud awareness of his mastery and the vanity of an artist. "When I became such a good hand at it," he went on, "there were village folk who said, 'Just go on, Misha, don't stop. Just go on whistling. You might please the gentry who travel by steamer. Maybe they'll get somewhere.' So off I went. Then I started riding on these here steamers. It's not too bad. I get on. At times they give so much money my eyes pop. Money's cheap to the gentry. He broke off, realizing that he had said too much, and then asked bashfully, "Would you have me whistle now?" A silence of several seconds ensued before the married lady commanded him curtly, "Whistle!" The boy threw the cap at his feet, put his fingers to his mouth, and arched his throat. For some reason his face was smiling, but he took some time to begin. First he pulled his fingers out of his mouth, wiped his lips, snorted, and made all kinds of grimaces. At last the yearning, sighing, whistling resounded again. It rang out and died away. And then suddenly the full lilting trill of a nightingale's roulade rang out in the air. The young lady quivered and sighed sadly. The married lady smiled glumly and contemptuously. Her companion hunched himself and grimaced nervously, and the old man stared seriously and intently at the boy's face. This latter had turned very red and swollen from the effort, but his dilated eyes remained dull and inexpressive, and did not illumine him in any way. The nightingale, crackled, trilled, and throbbing, stopped for an instant, and then renewed its singing, calling, and sighing nostalgically. The imitation was remarkably exact. "Papa, tell him to stop," the young lady said in a low voice. She suddenly rose and walked away, looking pale and with tears in her eyes. "Enough," the old man said with a wave of his hand. The nightingale broke off his song, wiped his lips with his hand, picked up the visored cap, and held it out towards the old man's hand. There was a rustling of paper. "My humble thanks," the boy said, and quickly disappeared, descending somewhat downstairs. The lady followed him with her eyes and smiled ironically. Her companion growled something to himself and raised the collar of his overcoat. The night deepened, growing thicker and darker. The water looked black now. The banks of the river were lost in the shadow. But the stars were already gleaming in the sky, and as before, the water churned monotonously beneath the paddle wheels of the steamer. "An artist," the old man exclaimed, changing his position. "Another victim of the public. That's how it is. The public will swallow anything that gives it pleasure. The weight lifting of a circus strongman and a virtuoso playing the violin. And it feels flattered when it observes that a man is ready to do anything in order to merit its attention." But apparently the others were not listening to him, for nobody answered. "But if that sailor had not come," he began again after a pause, "we would have remained convinced that we heard a bird famed by the poets rather than a scrubby little village lad, a pretender. Yes, to learn the truth is not so great a pleasure when the illusion is more beautiful." "Let's go," the lady said, rising. They all got up and went to their cabins. "Lena's probably weeping by now. She's such a nervous girl," the old man added. "But that's all right. Gradually she must get used to the trifling, foolish pranks of life. She'll find it easier to deal with larger and more serious issues." "Why are you trembling, Sonya? Is it the chill?" "No, it's nothing. Don't worry," the lady replied softly. Her nervous companion glanced indifferently at her through his colorless and ironically screwed-up eyes. Then they all disappeared behind the cabin door. The moon, ascending, cast her reflection upon the dark waters, and gleaming faintly they quivered on the vacillating surface of the waves. In the distance, quivering points of light appeared. A feeling of sadness hung over the drowsy river. And that story was The Nightingale by Maxim Gorky from Great Short Stories of the World, selected by the editors of Reader's Digest. The next story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. Gerald's Song by Philip F. O'Connor. My stocks have descended, my stocks are in pottery, and my stocks have descended. The soldiers destroy all the pottery where they are fighting. My stocks are in the company that imports that pottery. Other things are up, but my stocks are down. Down because of the war in that country where there is pottery. Once I said the boys are giving up their lives, so I should not complain. I did not start the war. I did not like the war. I put my money in pottery, not bullets. But I should not complain. The fighting boys have a right to complain, but I should not complain. It didn't work. I have my mother to think of. I live with her. I buy her things. She is tiny and pale and moves with a creak. She worries that I will have nothing when she dies. She says, "How was the pottery?" I say, "Down." She bends and she whistles and she says, "Oh, Gerald." The pottery looked good. The pottery had a future. The pottery was a sure thing. I put all of my money, the money my father left me, in the pottery. The pottery has gone down to a dollar, has nearly vanished. Oh, Gerald, oh, mother. I have wanted to do something. I've wanted to write to the stock exchange. I've wanted to write to the newspaper. I've wanted to write to the president. It is not good, this war. It is not good for any of us. But what can I do? What can I say? I can only fret, and what does that change? Oh, mother. Oh, Gerald. People can love each other. It was in the hope of people loving each other that I picked pottery. Pottery could let us know about other people. Civilization is to be found in pottery. I was hopeful when I put my money into it. I thought of poor families eating better because of the market for their pottery. I did not invest solely to make a profit. He who does that would be sinful. Oh, Gerald. Oh, mother. We look in the shops on Sunday, my mother and I. We look in the windows and pick out things for each other. My mother does not walk well. I stop with her for tea. She says, Gerald, you will look divine in that cravat. Oh, my heart is heavy. Oh, my soul is heavy. Soon there will be no more cravats. It's the war, mother. I have put everything in pottery, and now there is the war. The war, the war. Oh, mother. The war is taking everything away. I did not want to be a soldier. I could never have been a soldier. Her cousin helped us. He was on the draft board. It was not unfair. She was getting old. I could not go to the army with my mother getting old. I did not go. I stayed home and we played chess. She said, what are you going to do with your father's money? I said, put it in pottery. She said, are you sure that's wise? I said, pottery can't lose. Oh, the war, the war. What am I to do? The president said we have to be there. I believed him. Then the secretary of state said we have to stay there, and I believed him. Then our congressman said we have to bring this to a successful conclusion, or we can't show our faces anywhere in the world, and I believed him. I believe them all. But the pottery is down, and my mother is getting older. Gerald, you must do something. What can I do? You must do something. I will worry myself sick if you don't. What can I do? Don't let me down now. What can I do? She threw her teacup. It struck me on the forehead. Do something, you stupid boy, she said. Do something. I called our congressman and wired the Secretary of State and wrote a letter to the president. They all told me in one way or another that the war can't be stopped. I said to her, they can't stop it. I said, what's in, it's hard to get out. I know that from the pottery. You are as stupid as the government, she said. No one could have predicted as stupid as the government. I'm sorry, mother. What did you want to do with pottery anyway? I wanted to help the people in other countries. Let the sons of bitches help themselves. I'm sorry, mother. In your father's day, we let them help themselves. It was better. Yes, mother. Oh, Gerald, why can't they stop the stupid war? I wish they would. We'll be poor if they don't stop the war. Yes, mother. I went to my broker. I said, what can I do? He said, you shouldn't have invested in pottery. I said, but you told me to. He said, brokers make mistakes, too. We are only human. I said, do you have money in pottery? He said, my money is in bullets. I was lucky. I said, what can I do? He said, wait and hope. When the pottery goes up, we'll sell and put the money in bullets. The pottery didn't go up. My mother kicked the coffee table. She said, I've always lived well. I don't intend to live any other way now. I am old. My arthritis is acting up. How could you do this to me, Gerald? I'm sorry, mother. She spit at me. She wiggled her arms in the air. How could anyone be so stupid? She cursed and tried to get up. I think she was trying to attack me. She fell back. She nearly fell to the floor. Take it easy, mother. Who can take it easy on the way to the poorhouse? Oh, mother. I'm used to comfort, Gerald, and you are taking it from me. Oh, mother. Oh, Gerald. They didn't stop the war. My pottery is down to 30 cents. I have taken to not coming straight home after my work at the library. I have taken to stopping for a drink. I have another drink and then another, and then I worry that my mother has fallen off her chair, and I go home. She's always awake, sitting, rigid, staring down at my shirt front, saying, Gerald, you are always a dope. I can't bear the look she gives me. That's why I drink. I didn't try to lose my money. I didn't ask for the war. It is too late to get my money out now. I feel I'm going down. We're all going down. I don't want to go down. This is my life, and I want to live it. I don't understand the war. Politics bore me. Speeches bore me. I want more interesting things. I like books. I read about pottery when it's not busy in the reference room. I used to enjoy reading about pottery. Now it makes me sick, but it is my interest. I read about it. Pottery is made all over the world. There are different kinds of pottery for different countries. Pottery is one of the oldest things made. Mexican pottery is very pretty. My mother is old and dying. I didn't start this war. It was a happy country before the war. People could pursue their interests. Pottery was mine. It still is. I don't enjoy it as much as I used to. The war makes it less interesting. The war makes my mother irritable. The war is taking my money away. We have a hard time getting page boys at the library. They're all going into the army. Why they must go. Why we must fight. Who knows why we are fighting? Who knows what's important about that little country? What has happened that we don't know? What has happened that the congressman and the senator and the president can't help us? Why is there war? Who are those people we are fighting? What do they want with us? I would have gone on investing in their pottery. They could have made lots of money selling their pottery in this country. Did they sell it in another country? Is that why we are fighting them? There is a war, and I don't understand it. There is a war, and I don't understand it. There is a war, and I don't understand it. Oh, Mother. Oh, Gerald. And that's Gerald's song by Philip F. O'Connor from Sudden Fiction American Short Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.